Science for Till.
Yes.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry, sir. Miss Doolittle says she never wants to see anyone ever again.
But why? She was magnificent.
Magnificent? Do you have the right address, sir?
Of course. Tell her I'll wait.
But it may be days, sir, even weeks.
But don't you see? I'll be happier here.
People stop and stare. They don't want me. For there's nowhere else on earth that I would rather be. Let the time go by.
Higgins, if there's any mishap at the embassy tonight, if Miss Doolittle suffers any embarrassment, whatever, it's entirely on your head alone. I've been begging you to call off this experiment ever since Ascot.
Eliza can do anything.
I suppose she's discovered. I suppose she makes another ghastly mistake.
There were no horses at the ball, Pickering.
Think how agonizing it would be. God, if anything happened, I don't know what I'd do.
Well, you could always rejoin your regiment.
There's no time for flippancy, Higgins. The way you've driven her these last 6 weeks has exceeded all the bounds of... For God's sake, Higgins, stop pacing up and down. Can't you settle somewhere?
Have some port. It will quieten your nerves.
I'm not nervous. Where is it?
On the desk.
The car is here, sir.
Ah, thank you, Mrs. Pierce. Are you helping Eliza?
Yes, sir.
Helping it indeed, but the damn gown doesn't fit. I warned you about those French designers. We should have gone to a good English store where we knew everybody was on our side. Have some port.
No, thank you.
Are you so sure she'll retain all you've hammered into her?
We shall see.
Well, I suppose she doesn't.
Well, then I lose my bet.
You know what I can't stand about you, Higgins, is your confounded complacency. In a moment like this, with so much at stake, it's utterly indecent that you don't need a little port. What about the girl? You act as if she doesn't matter at all.
Oh, rubbish, Pickering. Of course she matters. What on earth do you think I've been doing all these months? What could possibly matter more than to take a human being and change her into a different human being by creating a new speech for her? Why, it's filling up a deepest gulf that separates class from class and soul from soul. Oh, she matters immensely.
Thank you. with Eliza's entrance ready for the ball in shimmering white silk and fur, we reach the end of Act One of Lerner and Lowe's My Fair Lady. Annalene Beechey is Eliza Doolittle, Anthony Andrews, Professor Henry Higgins, James Fleet, Colonel Hugh Pickering, and Jenny Galloway, Mrs. Pierce. At Ascot, we encountered Sian Phillips as Mrs. Higgins and Julian Avenden as Freddie Eynsford Hill. Alan Armstrong plays Alfred P. Doolittle. John Wilson conducts the John Wilson Orchestra. Well, as you may have realised during the applause and laughter here at the Royal Albert Hall, all sorts of visual gags going on, including a machine that shoots flames high into the air when H is properly pronounced. And lots of funny walks, long faces and physical tricks during that grand social meeting at the races. Well, if you've just joined us, welcome. It's the second night of the BBC Proms in a weekend when the stage is very much to the fore, as Sir John Eliot Gardiner conducting Debussy's Pelléas et Mélisande tomorrow evening. Every prom is preceded by an event across the road at the Royal College of Music, and we're going to bring you highlights of Proms Plus throughout the season here on Radio 3. In fact, that's what we're going to do right now for the next 20 minutes before Act 2 of My Fair Lady. My Fair Lady is based on George Bernard Shaw's play Pygmalion, which was the subject of tonight's Proms Plus, chaired by Matthew Sweet.
Tonight's prom is a musical theatre masterpiece from 1956, but it's based on material as old as the hills, specifically the hills on the island of Cyprus, where Ovid laid the tale of Pygmalion, the sculptor who loved his work so much he married it. In 1912, George Bernard Shaw hitched his name to the story, and it's now hard to think of Pygmalion and his creation Galatea without thinking of Professor Henry Higgins and the woman whom he tries to remake, Eliza Doolittle. We're going to explore the play with a cast whose names anyone would be happy to see in lights. Shaw's biographer, Michael Holroyd, and the historian Roy Foster, and bringing the play to life for us are the actors Rachel Sterling and Tim Pigott-Smith. Could we have found anyone better? Not bloody likely. In the myth of Pygmalion, the goddess Venus intervenes to bring life to an ivory statue, and everybody sort of lives reasonably happily ever after. Roy, what is Higgins' project? What does he want to do for or to Eliza?
Higgins' project is generally seen as a project based on class. He's going to get an uneducated flower girl and teach her to speak such perfect received English that she'll be mistaken for a duchess. He'll win his bet. But the question is, what'll happen to her? And that is what makes the play so fascinating, because what happens to her is that she turns out to be a creature of great natural intelligence and resource. And unlike in Pygmalion, she's not going to marry him, and she's going to find out the limitations of moving up a class and actually also losing your means of work. English people want this play to be about class. Shaw was an Irishman, and the Irish are much more interested in economics than class.
Michael, in the introduction, Shaw says that didactic plays are the only kind that are worth bothering with, really. What does he want to teach us?
The danger of being too didactic is one of the things I think he teaches us, and the fact that it's very difficult to have human relationships with people who you are teaching in a rather unsympathetic but expert way.
Roy, you said that you're rather disavowing the idea that class was an important part of that story, but surely, you know, this play is a product of 1912. This is a pretty kind of febrile time, isn't it, for questions of class and of gender?
Yes, it is, and of course class is a large part of it, because class and economics are intertwined. But you say 1912, Matthew, that's quite true. It's the time of the suffragette thing. It's the time when street traders are actually a very hot news issue. And it's a time when prostitution is a very hot issue. Shaw is fascinated by prostitution. Back to Pygmalion. Why does the sculptor in Ovid's fable want to make a fake woman? Because he believes all real women are whores. And why does Eliza keep saying, I'm a good girl, I'm a good girl? Why does she know what it means when somebody takes down something about her? The note taker is not who is Higgins actually taking down her voice pronunciation in the first act. She thinks that he's going to have her for soliciting men on the street. Shaw has already written a campaigning play about prostitution, Mrs. Warren's profession, in which he says, or I think probably in the preface he says, the prostitution isn't about men's licentiousness and women's depravity. It's about women of a certain class being undervalued, underpaid, and overworked. And that is, in a sense, the kind of economics that Liza's position is coming from. That's why I think it's a much more interesting play than I'm afraid My Fair Lady makes it out to be, which is all about class and romance.
Okay, well, let's have our first piece of performance from the play, which pits Professor Higgins against his creator, his mother, Mrs. Higgins, who will be played tonight by Rachel Sterling, and Professor Higgins by Tim Pigott-Smith.
I've picked up a girl.
Does that mean some girl has picked you up?
Not at all. Oh, God, I don't mean a love affair.
You're what a pity.
Why?
Well, you never fall in love with anyone under 45. When will you discover there are some rather nice-looking young women about?
Oh, I can't be bothered with young women. My idea of a lovable woman is something as like you as possible. Now, I shall never get into the way of seriously liking young women. Some habits lie too deep to be changed. Besides, they're all idiots.
Do you know what you would do if you really loved me, Henry?
No bother, what? Marry, I suppose.
No, stop fidgeting and take your hands out of your pockets. That's a good boy. Now, tell me about the girl.
Well, she's coming to see you.
I don't remember asking her.
You didn't. I asked her. If you'd known her, you wouldn't have asked her.
Indeed? Why?
Well, it's like this. She's a common flower girl. I picked her off the curbstone.
And invited her to my at home?
No, that'll be all right. I've taught her to speak properly. And she has strict orders as to her behaviour. She has to keep to two subjects, the weather and everybody's health. Fine day and how do, you know, and not let herself go on things in general. That'll be safe.
Safe? To talk about our health? About our insides? Perhaps about our outsides? How could you be so silly, Henry?
Thanks very much indeed, Tim Pigott-Smith and Rachel Sterling. Michael, would it be wrong to go looking for aspects of Shaw's biography in this relationship? Is his mother present here?
Well, biographers, of course, always think that this is relevant and is there. Higgins is not a pen portrait of Shaw, but he has, as I say, the same predicament. The good news is that Shaw loved his mother. The bad news is that she couldn't care for him at all. Not at all. And when she eventually left Dublin to go to London in the early 1870s, when Shaw, her son, was 15, 16, she took her two daughters and she left him with his semi-drunkard father, out-of-work father. And he felt for the rest of his life, really, in one way, that he was unlovable. He would have to create a new person outside himself called GBS, a public figure, who had, if not love, a lot of attention, and eventually quite a lot of money. And I think that this is at the center of this play. And what is strange outside the play is the first person he actually made love to, in the way that we would understand the word, was to his mother's best friend, someone who was over 45, and after his father had died, and he bought, with the money from his father's will, a new set of clothes, a new suit, from which he turned up. So it was really like the father and the mother all over again, only better this time.
Roy, that change jangling that we hear in that scene, what's that all about?
Well, it's probably about some form of sexual release, if you really want to look at it that way, because Higgins' sexuality is strangely arrested, and the exchange with his mother, in a sense, shows that. What Michael says is fascinating, because one of the stage directions for Mrs. Higgins is when she realizes it's her son who's come to see her, she is dismayed. You know, there's a rejection there. He has a form of what I might call, and I am an academic, academic Asperger's syndrome. You know, it's very common in places like Oxford, and he was based on, well, not based, but partly inspired by an Oxford don of phonetics. He is a sort of child who fidgets, who plays, who wants to be a confirmed bachelor all his life, whose idea of a perfect outcome at the end is when he suggests to Eliza that she lives with him and his friend, Colonel Pickering, like three old bachelors. So there's something really rather strange going on here, which Michael is not going to come
in. There is a sexual subtext, I think, to it, and you get it not quite so much in the words, but it's in the stage directions. I'd like just to quickly read some. Eliza tries to control herself. She's on the point of screaming. He comes to her. He pulls her up. She crisps her fingers frantically, gives a suffocated scream of fury, and instinctively darts her nails into his face. Higgins, catching her wrists, he throws her roughly into an easy chair. Liza, crushed by superior strength and weight. Higgins, thundering. Liza, with bitter submission. There's something there.
But this is violence instead of love, which occurs throughout. And when he tells her, oh, all right, go off and marry someone, he says, marry some fool with a thick pair of lips to kiss you with and a thick pair of boots to kick you with. And that's his idea of marriage.
Which sounds like an excellent moment to go to the next performance from the play. Michael, you've chosen this scene from Act Four, a terrific argument between Eliza and Henry, a kind of lover's argument, although by this stage they're no such thing.
It's after the ball, so she's had a fantastic night and looks absolutely ravishing.
Diamond sparkling.
Well, it's over and done with, and now I can go to bed at last without dreading tomorrow. Good night. Put out the lights, Eliza. And tell Mrs. Pierce not to make coffee for me in the morning. I'll take tea. Oh, what the devil have I done with my slippers?
There are your slippers. And there. Take your slippers and may you never have a day's luck with them.
What on earth? What's the matter? Get up. Anything wrong?
Nothing wrong with you. I've won your bet for you, haven't I? That's enough for you. I don't matter, I suppose.
You won my bet, presumptuous insect. I won it. What did you throw those slippers at me for?
Because I wanted to smash your face. I'd like to kill you, you selfish brute. Why didn't you leave me where you picked me out of, in the gutter? You thank God it's all over, and now you can throw me back again there, do you?
Yeah, the creature is nervous after all.
No!
How would you? Claws in, you cat. How dare you show your temper to me? Sit down and be quiet.
What's to become of me?
How the devil do I know what's to become of you? What does it matter what becomes of you?
You don't care. I know you don't care. You wouldn't care if I was dead. I'm nothing to you, not so much as them slippers.
Those slippers!
Those slippers! I didn't think it made any difference now.
So ferocious, isn't it, Michael?
This is very important to Shaw. In fact, he is rewriting the most important part of his early life. He was brought up in a ménage à trois. He had his father, George Shaw, who was the drunkard, and then there was this other man. The family were Protestant, but the other man was Catholic, and his name was Vander Lely, George Vander Lely, two Georges. He'd been called George after which one? Was he legitimate or illegitimate? What he is trying to do, always when he speaks of this, is to say that the relationship between his mother and Vander Lely, who taught his mother not how to speak, but how to sing. She had a mezzo-soprano voice, and she became the right-hand woman of his musical society. He wanted that to be an aesthetic and an economic relationship, not a sexual relationship, which made him illegitimate. So in this, there is great difficulty in getting Higgins, who is, in effect, really, George Vander Lely in many respects. He cannot marry her.
Right.
Yes, I think that's very characteristically perceptive, and I think it fits with the patterning of relationships in this play. Not only man-woman relationships, but father-child relationships. And the father-child relationship, which is also important, funny, bitter, sad, is between the wonderful character of Eliza's father, the philosophizing dustman, Mr. Doolittle, and his daughter, whom he is prepared to sell to Higgins in a hilarious but chilling exchange, where he says he can't afford middle-class morality. Of course he's prepared to sell her for £5. And when Colonel Pickering interposes, horrified, and says, Mr. Higgins's intentions are entirely honorable. Of course they are. If they weren't, I'd charge 50. And then and he explains that this may seem immoral to them, but to someone of his class and economic position is perfectly logical. It's about the illogic of capitalism, many of the best exchanges in this play.
Rachel, I want to bring you into this discussion. You've played Eliza on stage, a character that undergoes a metamorphosis every night. How much does Shaw help you manage those changes?
He manages it. It's perfect. It's the most perfect part, the beginning, middle, and the end. The guttersnipe she begins as, and the perfect articulate match to Higgins that she ends up as. It's the most perfectly arced part to play and deeply satisfying as a result. And I'm salivating thinking about it.
But do you ever lose sight of the idea that Eliza is a construction of some sort?
She's not a construction. She absolutely isn't a construction. What he does is he peels away her... he peels away her lack of vocabulary and reveals this incredibly articulate, intelligent, forward-thinking creature. But she was always that all along. That's what I took her to be. I don't think he created anything. I think he unveiled what was already there.
And the howl. The Eliza Doolittle howl. Because that, I mean, on the page, that does look like something that could be a musical gag or a line from a Punch cartoon.
And it isn't. It's her vocabulary as it is then. And in that sentence, she's saying all the things we can't say on BBC Three right now. It's an entire vocabulary of how she feels about this man who's taking notes of her at the time. I think it's one of the most articulate things in the play. I mean, it's quite... The first time you're doing a read-through or you come to it and you see it coming up, it's like Beecher's Brook. And you go, oh, my goodness, I'm going to have to make that noise in a minute. And then when you do, it's the most delicious sound to make.
Are they the test of a good Eliza?
Yeah. Sounds. Yeah, and a good gorn. Do you want me...
Oh, yes, let's hear one.
I have to move back from the microphone because it's so loud. It goes like this.
Rachel and I were both in a Peter Hall production at different times, the same production at different times, and Peter's great strength was that he really thought this was about social manipulation, and he took it very, very seriously, and it just got funnier and funnier.
Roy Foster.
I'm very glad that point's been made. I saw that Peter Hall production, and I thought it was the best, and I'm not just saying this because two people are in it on the stage, it is the best Pygmalion I've ever seen, because it got the darkness and the sadness of, especially of Eliza's situation towards the end. And I think what Peter Hall said was that it was a play about heartbreak. And interestingly, when Shaw himself, then not very far advanced as a writer of plays himself, saw his fellow Irishman Oscar Wilde's smash hit, The Importance of Being Earnest, in 1895, he didn't like it because he said it was a heartless play. And he said that a great comedy had to have heart. And I think that's exactly what Pygmalion has.
I think that he was very vulnerable about this play because, after all, it was written for Stella Campbell, with whom, now that his mother had died, he was free to fall in love with and really did so. And it was a tragedy for him. During the rehearsal, she vanished for 3 days and she came back married to someone else, someone with the name George again, Cornwallis West, like Ainsford Hill, a hyphenated nobody. And he really felt that all those things he had tried to put off feeling, he now felt.
Was that in some way a response to the play itself, her action?
No, it was response to Cornwallis West having the day before got his divorce.
But one would like to think in a way that Stella Campbell, seeing Eliza's dilemma and wanting to be loved, thought Eliza had the sense to choose Freddie Ainsford Hill, who knows how to love her, instead of this astonishing, didactic, strange, genius who relates to other people in an arrested way,
that's
which
right,
she may have seen Shaw as.
Just at that point, he had left that GBS person behind. He dared to come out from that, and it didn't work. That's the sad thing.
Oh, God, I wish I was dead.
Why? In heaven's name, why? Listen to me, Eliza. All this irritation is purely subjective.
I don't understand. I'm too ignorant.
It's only imagination, low spirits and nothing else. Nobody's hurting you, nothing's wrong. Now, you go to bed like a good girl and sleep it off. Have a little cry and say your prayers, and that'll make you comfortable.
I heard your prayers. Thank God it's all over.
Well, don't you thank God it's all over? Now you're free and you can do what you like.
What am I fit for? What have you left me fit for? Where am I to go? What am I to do? What's to become of me?
Oh, that's what's worrying you, is it? Well, I shouldn't bother about it if I were you. I should imagine you won't have much difficulty in settling yourself somewhere or other, though I hadn't quite realized you're going away. You might marry, you know. You see, Eliza, all men are not confirmed old bachelors like me and the Colonel. Most men are the marrying sort, poor devils. And you're not bad looking. It's quite a pleasure to look at you sometimes. Well, not now, of course, because you're crying and looking as ugly as the very devil. But when you're all right and quite yourself, you're what I should call attractive. That is to people in the marrying line, you understand. Now, you go to bed and have a good, nice rest and then get up and look at yourself in the glass and you won't feel so cheap. I dare say my mother could find some chap or other who'd do very well.
We were above that at the corner of Tottenham Court Road.
What do you mean?
I sold flowers. I didn't sell myself. Now you've made a lady of me, I'm not fit to sell anything else. I wish you'd left me where you found me.
Shaw wrote with typical disingenuousness after it had been this fabulous success. He said, "This play has pleased so many different kinds of people that there must be something radically wrong with it." But I have never been able to discover what it was.
That's the last bit.
In fact, of course, it pleases so many people because there's something radically right about it, I think.
Thank you so much. Okay, well, we have to bring the curtain down there at this point. A great shame, because enjoyable conversations like this between authors, academics and hackers hardly ever happen. My thanks to Roy Foster and Michael Holroyd, Tim Biggert-Smith and Rachel Sterling, and I suspect that you'll want to give them yours too.
Matthew Sweet presented this evening's Proms Plus literary event, and the producer was Allegra McElroy. Well, welcome back, live to the Royal Albert Hall this Saturday evening, where we're about to return you to London a century ago and Act Two of Lerner and Lowe's comedy of class, My Fair Lady. Anthony Andrews is starring tonight in the role that he played in the West End. It's a show that he is a huge fan of.
I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say that it's the greatest musical ever written. It has such a wonderful combination of words and music. Not surprisingly, because an awful lot of it is the original Bernard Shaw. Even within the lyrics, Alan J. Lerner had this incredible skill to be able to marry the two. I think that's why it's such a joy to play, because you get some very deep, meaningful scenes and some very funny ones too, interspersed with all this fabulous music.
Anthony Andrews, who plays Henry Higgins opposite Annalene Beechey's Eliza Doolittle here at the Proms, joining James Fleet as Colonel Pickering, Alan Armstrong as Alfred P. Doolittle, Sean Phillips playing Mrs. Higgins, Julian Ovenden as Freddy Eynsford Hill, and Jenny Galloway as Mrs. Pierce. John Wilson is in charge. It's the John Wilson Orchestra. Here he is to conduct Act Two of Lerner and Lowe's My Fair Lady. Thank you.
Reginald and Lady Tarrington. Professor Sultan Kapathi. Colonel Hugh Pickering.
I've heard several people asking who she is. Do tell me what happened.
Well, Higgins said, Madam Ambassador, may I introduce Miss Eliza Doolittle? And Madam Ambassador said, how do you do? And Eliza came right back with, how do you do?
Is that all?
No. When it was my turn, both the ambassador and his wife said to me, Colonel Pickering, who is that captivating creature with Professor Higgins?
What did you say?
Well, I was stopped for a moment. Then I collected myself, and I said, Eliza Doolittle.
That was very quick thinking, yeah. Colonel.
Yes, thank you, Mrs. Higgins. Do you think Eliza will make it?
Oh, I hope so. I've grown so fond of that girl.
Professor Henry Higgins!
Maestro, maestro, you remember me?
No, I don't. Who the devil are you?
I am your pupil, your first, best, and greatest pupil. I am Zoltan Kapadi, that marvelous boy. I make your name across Europe. You teach me phonetics. You cannot forget me.
Why don't you shave?
I do not have your imposing appearance, your figure, your brow. No one notices me when I shave.
Where did you get all those old coins?
Decorations for languages. The Queen of Transylvania is here this evening. I am indispensable to her at these international parties. I know 32 languages. I know everyone in Europe. No imposter escaped my detection. And now, Professor, you must introduce me to that glorious creature you escort here this evening. She fascinates everyone, not since Lily Langtry came to London and everyone...
His Excellency, Dr. Themistocles Stephanos.
This so-called Greek diplomat pretend he cannot speak English, but he cannot deceive me. He is the son of a Yorkshire watchmaker. He speaks English so villainously, he dare not utter a single word of it without betraying his origin. He does not deceive me. I help him to pretend. I make him pay for the nose. I make them all pay. I look forward to meeting your lady.
Higgins, I say.
Where's Eliza?
Upstairs. Last-minute adjustments.
I say, Higgins, let's not risk it. Let's collect her and leave immediately.
Do you think it wise to stay?
Wise to stay? Why ever not? If he finds her out, I'll lose my bet.
Miss Eliza Doolittle.
Professor, you must introduce me.
Thank you. immense achievement.
Oh, silly notion. If I hadn't packed myself to do it, I'd have chucked the whole thing up 2 months ago.
Absolutely fantastic.
A lot of tomfoolery.
Higgins, I salute you.
Nonsense, silly people don't know their own silly business.
Turned out, man, you did it. You did it. You did it. You said that you would do it, and indeed you did. I thought that you would rue it. I doubted you'd do it. But now I must admit it, that succeed you did. You should get a medal, or we even made a knight.
It was nothing. Really nothing.
All alone, you hurdled every obstacle in sight.
Now wait. Now wait. Give credit where it's due. A lot of the glory goes to you.
But you're the one who did it, who did it, who did it. The sturdiest you brought her, not a second that you fought her. There's no doubt about it. You did it. Oh, I must have aged a year tonight. At times I thought I'd die of fright. Never was there a momentary lull.
Shortly after we came in, I knew at once that we'd easily win. And after that, I found it deadly dull.
You should have heard the oohs and ahs. Everyone wondering who she was.
You'd think they'd never seen a lady before.
And when the Prince of Transylvania asked to meet her and gave his arm to lead her to the floor, you did it! You did it! You did it! They thought she was ecstatic and so damned aristocratic, and they never knew that you did it!
Oh, well, thank heaven for Sultan Kapathi. If it weren't for him, I think I'd have died of boredom.
Kapathi? That dreadful Hungarian, was he there?
Oh, yes. He was there, all right. And up to his old tricks. That blackguard who uses the science of speech, more to blackmail and swindle than teach. He made it the devilish business of his to find out who this Miss Doolittle is. Every time we turned around, there it was, that hairy hound from Budapest. Never leaving us alone, never have I ever known a rude passion. Finally, I decided it was foolish not to let him have his chance with her. So I stepped aside and let him dance with her. Oozing charm through every pore, he oiled his way around the floor. Every trick that he could play, he used to strip her mask away. And when at last the dance was done, he glowed as though he knew he'd won. With a voice too eager and a smile too broad, he announced to the hostess that she was a fraud.
No.
Yavon. English is too good, he said, which clearly indicates that she is foreign. Whereas others are instructed in their native language, English people. And although she may have studied with an expert dialectician or grammarian, I can tell that she was born Hungarian! Not only Hungarian, but of royal blood! She is a princess. Her blood is said is bluer than the Danube is her ever was. Royalty is absolutely written on her face. She thought I was taking the introduction, the I never was. How could she deceive another member of her race? I know which language on the map, said he, and she's Hungarian as the first Hungarian rhapsody.
Congratulations! Congratulations!
heaven, that's all over. Now at last I can go to bed without dreading tomorrow.
Good night, Mr. Higgins.
Good night, Mrs. Pierce.
I think I shall turn into Higgins. It's been a great occasion. Good night.
Good night, Pick. Oh, Mrs. Pierce! I wanted to tell her that I want coffee in the morning instead of tea. Oh, leave a little note for her, would you, Eliza? No. I'll lose my head eventually. What the devil have I done with my slippers?
There are your slippers, and there! Take your slippers, and may you never have a day's luck with them!
What on earth? What's the matter? Is anything wrong?
Nothing wrong with you. I've won your bet for you, haven't I? That's enough for you. I don't matter, I suppose.
You won my bet, you presumptuous insect. I won it. What the devil did you throw those slippers at me for?
Because I wanted to smash your face. I'd like to kill you, you selfish brute! Why didn't you leave me where you picked me out of, in the gutter? You thank God that now it's all over and you can throw me back again there, do you?
Oh, so the creature is nervous after all.
Ah!
Claws in, you cat! How dare you show your temper to me! Sit down and be quiet!
What's to become of me? What's to become of
me? How the devil do I know what's to become of you? What does it matter what becomes of you?
You don't care. I know you don't care. You wouldn't care if I was dead. I'm nothing to you. Not so much as them slippers.
Those slippers.
I didn't think it made any difference now.
Why have you suddenly begun going on like this? May I ask if you complain of your treatment here?
No.
Has anybody behaved badly toward you, Colonel Pickering, Mrs. Pierce?
No.
You can't pretend that I have treated you badly.
No.
Oh, well, I'm very relieved to hear that. Oh, well, perhaps you're tired after the strain of the day. Have a chocolate.
No. Thank you.
Well, it is only natural you should be anxious. But it's all over now. Nothing more to worry about, eh?
No. Nothing more for you to worry about. Oh, God, I wish I was dead.
Why? In heaven's name, why? Oh, listen, Eliza. All this irritation is merely subjective.
I don't understand. I'm too ignorant.
It's only irritation. Nothing wrong. No one's hurting you. Listen, you go to bed. Sleep it off like a good girl. Have a good cry. Say your prayers. You'll feel more comfortable.
I heard your prayers. Thank God it's all over.
Well, don't you? Thank God it's all over. Now you're free. You can do whatever you want.
What am I fit for? What have you left me fit for? Where am I to go? What am I to do? What's to become of me?
Oh, that's what's worrying you, is it? Oh, well, I would imagine you won't have much difficulty in settling yourself somewhere or other. Though I hadn't quite realized that you were going away. You know, you might marry, you know. You see, Eliza, not all men are confirmed old bachelors like me and the Colonel. Most men are the marrying sort. Poor devils. And you're not bad looking. You're quite a pleasure to look at sometimes. Not now, of course, because you've been crying and you look as ugly as the very devil. When you're all right, when you're quite yourself, you're what I might call, well, attractive. Oh, come on, Eliza. You go to bed, get a good night's sleep, get up in the morning, look at yourself in the glass. You won't feel so cheap. You know, I dare say my mother could find some chap or other who would do very well.
We were above that in Covent Garden.
What do you mean?
I sold flowers. I didn't sell myself. Now that you've made a lady of me, I'm not fit to sell anything else.
Oh, tosh, Eliza. Don't insult human relations by dragging all that cant about buying and selling into it. You needn't marry the fellow if you don't want to.
What else am I to do?
Lots of things. Well, what about the old idea of the florist shop? Pickering could set you up in one. He's pots of money. And he'll have to pay for all those togs you've been wearing. And that, together with the hire of the jewellery, could put a big hole in... £200. Oh, come on, Eliza. You're all right. Oh, well, I must off to bed. I'm devilish sleepy. I was looking for something. Now, what was it?
Your slippers.
Oh, yes. You shied them at me.
Before you go, sir.
Sir?
Do my clothes belong to me or to Colonel Pickering?
Well, what the devil use would they be to Pickering? And why bother about that in the middle of the night?
I want to know what I may take away with me. I don't want to be accused of stealing.
Stealing? Oh, you ought not to have said that, Eliza. That shows a want of feeling.
I'm sorry. I'm only a common, ignorant girl, and in my station I have to be careful. There can't be any feelings between the like of you and the like of me. Please, will you tell me what belongs to me and what doesn't?
You may take the whole damn houseful if you like, except the jewels, they're hired. Now, will that satisfy you?
Wait, please. You take these with you. I don't want to run the risk of their being missing.
Hand them over. If these belong to me instead of the jeweler, I'd ram them down your ungrateful throat.
This ring isn't the jeweler's. It's the one you bought me in Brighton. I don't want it now. Don't you hit me!
Hit you, you infamous creature! How dare you accuse me of such a thing! It's you who have hit me. You've wounded me to the heart.
I'm glad. I've got a little of my own back anyhow.
You have caused me to lose my temper. Something that's hardly ever happened to me before. I prefer to say nothing more tonight. I'm going to bed.
You'd better leave your own note for Mrs. Pierce about the coffee, for it won't be done by me.
Damn Mrs. Pierce. Damn the coffee. And damn you. And damn my own folly for having lavished my hard-earned knowledge and the treasure of my regard and intimacy on a heartless guttersnipe.
Where you live, are the lilac trees
I spend most of my time here. Well, don't laugh at me, Miss Doolittle, but
Freddy,
that's the only...
You don't think I'm a heartless gutter snipe, do you?
Oh, no, darling. How can you imagine such a thing? You know how I feel. I've written you 2 and 3 times a day telling you. Sheets and sheets. Speak, and the world is full of singing, and I am winging higher than the birds. Touch, and my heart begins to crumble, the heavens tumble, darling, and I'm...
Words, I'm so sick of words. I get words all day through, first from him, now from you. Is that all you blighters can do? Don't say how much. Show me. Don't talk of love lasting through time. Make me know undying God. Show me now. Sing me no song, read me no rhyme. Don't waste my time. Show me. Please don't or beseech, don't make a speech, show me. Never do I ever want to hear another word. There isn't one I haven't heard. Here we are together in what ought to be a dream. Say one more word and I'll scream. Haven't your arms hungered for mine? Please don't explain, show me, show me.
Can I help you?
Do you mind if I warm my hands?
Go right ahead, miss.
Yes?
Sorry, miss. For a second there, I thought you were someone else.
Who?
Sorry, ma'am. Early morning light playing tricks with me eyes.
Can I get you a taxi, miss? A lady like you shouldn't be walking around London this time in the morning.
No, thank you.
Good morning, miss.
Someone's head resting on my knee. Warm and tender as he can be. Who takes good care.
To you, George. Time to go, Alfie.
Oh, do come again, Mr. Doolittle. We value your patronage.
Thank you, my good man. Here, take the missus a trip to Brighton.
Oh. Thank you very much, Mr. Doolittle.
Father.
Ah, you see, Harry? He has no mercy. Sent her down to spy on me in me misery, he did. Me own flesh and blood. Well, I'm miserable, all right. You can tell him that straight.
What are you talking about? What are you all dressed up for?
As if you didn't know. Go on back to that Wimpole Street devil and tell him what he done to me.
What has he done to you?
He's ruined me, that's all. Destroyed me happiness. Tied me up and delivered me into the hands of middle-class morality. And don't you defend him. Was it him or was it not him that wrote an American blighter named Wonderfella? And that was giving $5 million to found moral reform societies and tell him the most original moralist in England was Mr. Alfred P. Doolittle, a common dustman.
That sounds like one of his jokes.
Yeah, you might call it a joke. You put the lid on me right enough. The bloke died and left me £4,000 a year in his blooming will.
Come on, Alfie. In a couple of hours, we've got to be at the church.
Church?
Yes, church. The deepest cut of all. Why do you think I'm dressed up like a ruddy pallbearer? Your stepmother wants to marry me. Now I'm respectable, she wants to be respectable.
If that's how you feel, why don't you give the money back?
That's the tragedy of it, Eliza. It's easy to say, chuck it, but I haven't the nerve. We're all intimidated. Yeah. Intimidated, Eliza, that's what we are. And that's what I am. Balked up.
Well, he's not my precious professor.
Ah, oh, sent you back, has he? You see, first he shoves me in the middle class, then he chucks you out for me to support you. All part of his plan. But you double-cross him, Eliza. Don't you come home to me. Don't you take tuppence off me. You stand on your own 2 feet. You're a lady now, and you can do it.
Eliza, it's getting awfully cold in that taxi.
I say, you want to come and see me turned off this morning? St. George's, Hanover Square, 10 o'clock. I wouldn't advise it, but you're welcome.
No, thank you, Dad.
Are you all finished here?
Yes, Freddy. I'm all finished here. about Dad.
Come on, Alfie. How much time do I have left?
There's just a few more hours. That's all the time you've got. A few more hours before they tie the knot.
There are drinks and girls all over London, and I've got to track them down in just a few more hours. I'm getting married in the morning. Ding-dong, the bells are gonna chime. Pull out the stopper, let's have a whopper, but get me to the church on time. I've got to be there in the morning, spruced up and looking in me prime. Girls, come and kiss me, show how you'll miss me, but get me to the church on time. If I am dancing, roll up the floor. If I am whistling, meet me at the door. Oh, I'm getting married in the morning. Ding dong, the bells are gonna chime. Kick up a rumpus, but don't lose the compass, and get me to the church.
Get into the church.
For God's sake, get me to the church. On time.
He's getting married in the morning. Ding dong, the bells are gonna chime. Some bloke who's able, lift up the table, and get me to the church on time. If he is flying, then shoot him down. If he is wooing, get her out of town. For he's getting married in the morning. Ding dong, that's I'm gonna chime.
Feather and Tommy, call out the army, but get me to the church. Get me to the church. The gold side, get me to the church.
Oh, he's getting married in the morning. Ding dong, the bells are gonna chime.
Call out the stopper, let's have a whopper, but get me to the church on time.
He's gonna be there in the morning, stretched up and looking in his prime.
Girls, come and kiss me, hey. Shout out your name, I get me to the church on time. If I am dancing, if I am whistling, meet me at the door.
For he's getting married in the morning.
Drag me and tie me, stab me and Miley, and get me to the church.
Get into the church.
For God's sake, get me to the church.
She took them all with her.
Pickering!
What? What?
Here's a confounded thing. Eliza has bolted.
Bolted?
Yes, bolted. And Mrs. Pierce let her go without telling me a thing about it.
Well, I'm dashed.
Well, what am I to do? I got tea this morning instead of coffee. I don't know where anything is. I've no idea what appointments I've got.
Eliza would know.
Well, of course she'd know, but she's gone, damn it!
Did either of you gentlemen frighten her last night?
Well, you were there, Mrs. Pierce. We hardly said a word to her. Higgins, did you bully her after I went to bed?
It was quite the other way around. She threw the slippers at me. I never gave her the slightest provocation. The slippers just came bang at my head before I'd uttered a word. And she used the most awful language. I was shocked.
Well, I'm dashed.
I don't understand it. We've always shown her every consideration. She said so herself.
Well, I'm dashed.
Oh, Pickering, for God's sake, stop being dashed and do something.
What?
Well, telephone the police. What are they there for, in heaven's name?
But Mr. Higgins, you can't give Eliza's name to the police as if she were a thief or a lost umbrella.
Why not? I want to find her. She belongs to me. I paid £5 for her.
Yeah, quite right. Scotland Yard, please. May I have some coffee, Mrs. Pearson?
Yes, sir.
Good morning, old chap. Colonel Hugh Pickering here, 27A Wimpole Street. I want to report a missing person. Anything you could do to assist in the recovery will be frightfully appreciated. I'm not without influence, and I'll see to it that you're... Yes. Eliza Doolittle. Yes. About 21. Well, I should say about 5'7". Her eyes.
Brown.
Brown. Her hair. Well, it's a rather neutral, nondescript sort of colour. I'd say it's more on the. It's on the
brown, the brown, brown.
You heard what he said. It's brown. Yeah. Yes. This is her residence. Between 3 and 4 in the morning. No. No relation at all. No, let's just say a good friend. Now, see here, my good man, I'm not at all pleased with the tenor of that question. What the girl does here is our affair. Your affair is to get her back so she can continue doing it.
What in all of heaven could have prompted her to go after such a triumph at the ball? What could have depressed her? What could have possessed her? I cannot understand the wretch at all.
Higgins, I have an old school chum at the Home Office. Perhaps he can help. I'll call him. Whitehall 7244, yes?
Women are irrational, that's all there is to that. Their heads are full of cotton, hay and rags. They're nothing but exasperating, irritating, vacillating, calculating, agitating, maddening and infuriating hags.
Brewster Budgeon, please. Yes, yes, I'll wait.
Pickering, why can't a woman be more like a man? Why can't a woman be more like a man? Men are so honest, so thoroughly square, eternally noble, historically fair. When you win, we'll always give your back a pat. Now, why can't a woman be like that? Why does everyone do what the others do? Can't a woman learn to use her head? Why do they do everything their mothers do? Why can't they grow up? Well, like their fathers instead. Why can't a woman take after a man? Men are so pleasant, so easy to please. Whenever you're with them, you're always at ease. Would you be slighted if I didn't speak for hours?
Of course not.
Would you be livid if I hadn't drink or two?
Nonsense.
Would you be wounded if I never sent you flowers?
Never.
Well, why can't a woman be like you? One man in a million may shout a bit. Now and then there's one with slight defects. One perhaps whose truthfulness you doubt a bit. But by and large we are a marvellous sex. Why can't a woman behave like a man? Men are so friendly, good-natured and kind. A better companion you never would find. If I were hours late for dinner, would you bellow?
Of course not.
If I forgot your silly birthday, would you fuss?
Nonsense.
Would you complain if I took out another fella?
Never.
Well, why can't a woman be like us?
Brewster Budgeon, please. Yes. Boozy! You'll never, 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 never guess who this is. Yes, 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 it is. By George, what a memory. Yes, how are you, old chap? It's so good to hear your voice again. 30 years, is it really? Yes. Yeah, oh, yeah. Oceans of water, yes, yeah. Yeah, Boozy, old chap, I'll tell you why I called. Something rather unpleasant has happened at this end. Could I come right over and see you? Oh, good, yeah, I'll be right there. Thank you, Boozy. I'm going over to the Home Office, Mrs. Pierce.
Oh, I do hope you find her, Colonel Pickering. Mr. Higgins will miss her.
Mr. Higgins will miss her. Blast, Mr. Higgins. I'll miss her.
Pickering! Pickering! Oh, Mrs. Pierce, where's the Colonel?
He's gone to the Home Office, sir.
There you are, you see. I'm disturbed. He runs for help. Now there's a good fellow. Mrs. Pierce, you're a woman. Why can't a woman be more like a man? Men are so decent, such regular chaps. Ready to help you through any mishaps. Ready to buck you up whenever you are glum. Why can't a woman be a chum? Why is thinking something women never do? Why is logic never even tried? Straightening out their hair is all they ever do. Why can't they straighten tongue out the mess that's inside? Why can't a woman be more like a man? If I were a woman who'd been to a ball, been hailed as a princess by one and by all, would I start weeping like a bathtub overflowing? Or carry on as though my home were in a tree? Would I run off and never tell me where I'm going? Why can't a woman be like me? Thank you.
And you mean to say, after you did this wonderful thing for them without making a single mistake, they just sat there and didn't say a word, never petted you or admired you or told you how splendid you'd been?
Not a word.
Oh, that's simply appalling. I should not have thrown the slippers at him. I should have thrown the fire irons.
Mother! Mother!
I thought it wouldn't be long. Stay where you are, my dear.
Mother, where the devil are you?
Remember, last night you not only danced with a prince, you behaved like a princess.
Mother, the damnedest thing has happened. You?
How do you do, Professor Higgins? Are you quite well? But of course you are. You are never ill. Would you care for some tea?
Don't you dare try that game on me. I taught it to you. Now get up and come home, and don't be a fool. You've caused me enough trouble for one morning.
Very nicely put, Henry. No woman could resist such an invitation.
Well, how did this baggage get to be here in the first place?
Eliza came to see me, and I was delighted to have her. And if you don't promise to behave yourself, I shall have to ask you to leave.
What do you mean to say I'm to put on my Sunday manners for this thing that I created out of the squashed cabbage leaves of Covent Garden?
Yes, dear. That is precisely what I mean.
I'll see her damned first. Come along!
How did you ever learn manners with my son around?
It was very difficult. I should never have known how ladies and gentlemen behave if it hadn't been for Colonel Pickering. Ah! He always showed me that he felt and thought about me as if I was something better than a common flower girl. You see, Mrs. Higgins, apart from the things one can pick up, the difference between a lady and a flower girl is not how she behaves, but how she is treated. I shall always be a flower girl to Professor Higgins, because he always treats me as a flower girl and always will. But I know that I shall always be a lady to Colonel Pickering, because he always treats me as a lady and always will.
Please don't grind your teeth, Henry.
The bishop is here, madam. Shall I show him in?
The bishop and the professor? Heavens, no, I'll be excommunicated. I'll see him in the library.
Yes, madam.
Eliza, if my son begins to break things, I give you full permission to have him evicted. Henry, dear, if I were you, I should stick to two subjects, the weather and your health.
Well, Eliza, you had a bit of your own back, as you call it. Have you had enough? Are you going to be reasonable? Or do you want any more?
You want me back only to pick up your slippers, put up with your tempers, and fetch and carry for you.
I haven't said I want you back at all.
Oh, indeed. And what are we talking about?
About you, not about me. If you come back, I shall treat you exactly as I've always treated you. I can't change my nature. I've no intention of changing my manners. My manners are exactly the same as Colonel Pickering's.
That's not true. He treats a flower girl as if she was a duchess.
Yes, and I treat a duchess as though she were a flower girl.
Oh, I see. The same to everybody.
Just so, Eliza. You see, the great secret is not having good manners or bad manners or any particular sort of manners, but having the same manner to all human souls.
Amen.
The question is, Eliza, not whether I've treated you badly, but whether you've ever heard me treat anybody else better.
I don't care how you treat me. I don't mind your swearing at me. I shouldn't mind a black eye. I've had one before this, but I won't be passed over.
Then get out of my way, because I won't stop for you. You talk about me as though I were a motorbus.
So you are a motorbus. All bounce and go and no consideration for anyone. But I can get along without you. Don't think I can't.
Oh, I know you can. I told you you could. I don't suppose you've ever given any thought to whether I can get along without you.
Don't try to get around me. You'll have to.
And so I shall, without you or any soul on earth. But I have missed you, Eliza. I confess that. I've learned something from your idiotic notions. I confess it both humbly and gratefully.
Well, you have my voice on your gramophone. When you feel lonely without me, you can turn it on. It's got no feelings to hurt.
I can't turn your soul on.
Oh, you are a devil. You can twist the heart in a girl as easily as some can twist her arm to hurt her. What am I to come back for?
For the fun of it! That's why I took you on.
And you may throw me out tomorrow if I don't do everything you want me to?
Yes, and you may walk out tomorrow if I don't do everything you want me to.
And live with my father?
Yes, or sell flowers.
If only I could.
Well, you can always marry Pickering.
I wouldn't marry you if you asked me, and you're nearer my age than what he is.
Than he is.
I'll talk as I like. You're not my teacher now. That's not what I want from you, and don't you think it. I've always had chaps enough wanting me that way. Freddie Hill writes to me twice and three times a day, sheets and sheets.
Oh, in short, you want me to be as infatuated with you as he is that it?
No, I don't. That's not what the sort of feeling I want from you.
Then what in heaven's name are we arguing about?
I want a little kindness. I know I'm a common, ignorant girl, and you a book-learned gentleman. But I am not dirt under your feet. What I did, was not for the dresses and the taxis. I did it because we were pleasant together. And I came to care for you. Not to want you to make love to me and not forgetting the difference between us, but more friendly-like.
Yes. That's just how I feel. And how Pickering feels. Eliza, you're a fool.
It's not a proper answer to give me.
Well, it's the only one you're going to get till you stop being a plain idiot. You find me cold, unfeeling, and selfish, don't you? Oh, very well, be off with you to the sort of people you like. Marry some sentimental hog or other with pots of money and a thick pair of lips to kiss you with and a thick pair of boots to kick you with. If you can't appreciate what you've got, you better go and find what you can appreciate.
I can't talk to you. You turn everything against me. I'm always in the wrong. But don't think you have me under your feet to be trampled on and talked down. I'll marry Freddy, I will. Just as soon as I'm able to support him.
Freddy? That idiot who couldn't get a job as an errand boy even if he had the guts to try for it? Woman, don't you understand? I've made you a consort for a king!
Freddy loves me. That makes him king enough for me. I don't want him to work. He wasn't brought up to it as I was. I'll go and be a teacher.
Ugh, what will you teach in heaven's name?
What you taught me. I'll teach phonetics.
Ah, ha, ha.
I'll offer myself as an assistant to that brilliant Hungarian.
What? That imposter, that humbug, that toadying ignoramus? Teach him my methods? You take one step in that direction, and I'll wring your neck, you hear me?
Get away! What do I care? I knew you'd strike me one day. Aha. That's done you, Henry Higgins, it has. Now I don't care that for your bullying and your big talk. What a fool I was. What a dominated fool. To think you were the earth and sky. What a fool I was. What an addle-pated fool. What a mutton-headed dolt was I. No, my reverberating friend. You are not the beginning and the end.
You impudent hussy. There isn't an idea in your head or a word in your mouth that I haven't put there.
There'll be spring every year without you. England still will be here without you. There'll be fruit on the tree and a shore by the sea. There'll be crumpets and tea without you. Art and music will thrive without you. Somehow Keats will survive without you. And there still will be rain on that plain down in Spain. Even that will remain without you. I can do without you. You dear friend who talks so well. You can go to Hartford, Hereford, and Hampshire. They can still rule the land without you. Windsor Castle will stand without you. And without my
much ado we can all muddle through without you.
Brazen hussy.
Without your pulling it, the tide comes in. Without your twirling it, the earth can spin. Without your pushing them, the clouds roll by. If they can do without you, Ducky, so can I. I shall not feel alone without you. I can stand on my own without you. So go back in your shell. I can do bloody well without
you. George, I really did it. I did it. I did it. I said I'd wake a woman, and indeed I did. I knew I could do it. I knew it. I knew it. I said I'd make a woman and succeed. I did. Oh, Eliza, you are magnificent. 5 minutes ago, you were a millstone round my neck. Now you're a tower of strength, a consort battleship. Oh, I like you like this.
Goodbye, Professor Higgins. I shall not be seeing you again.
Mother! Mother!
What is it, Henry? What has happened?
She's gone.
Yes, dear. What did you expect?
Well, what am I to do?
Do without, I suppose.
And so I shall. If the Higgins oxygen burns up her little lungs, let her seek some stuffiness that suits her. She's an owl, sickened by a few days in my sunshine. Oh, very well, let her go. I can do without her. I can do without anybody. I've got my own soul, my own spark of divine fire.
Bravo, Eliza.
Grown accustomed to her face. She almost makes the day begin. I've grown accustomed to the tune she whistles night and noon. Her smiles, her frowns, her ups, her downs are second nature to me now. Like breathing out, breathing in, I was serenely independent and content before we met. Surely I can always be that way again. And yet, I've grown accustomed to her looks, accustomed to her voice, accustomed to her face. Marry Freddy? What an infantile idea. What a heartless, wicked, brainless thing to do. But she'll regret it. She'll regret it. It's doomed before they even take that vow. I can see her now, Mrs. Freddy Eynsford Hill, in a wretched little flat above a store. I can see her now, not a penny in the till, and a bill collector beating at the door. She'll try to teach the things I taught her, and end up selling flowers instead, begging for her bread and water while her husband has his breakfast in bed. In a year or so, when she's prematurely grey and the blossom in her cheek has turned to chalk, she'll come home and lo, he'll have up to run away with a social climbing heiress from New York. Poor Eliza, how simply frightful. How delightful. How poignant it will be on that inevitable night when she hammers on my door in tears and rags.
miserable and lonely, repentant and contrite. Will I let her in or hurl her to the wolves? Will I show her kindness or the treatment she deserves? Will I take her back or throw the baggage out? I'm a most forgiving man. The sort who never could, ever would, take a position and staunchly never budge. Just a most forgiving man. But I will never take her back. If she were crawling on her knees, let her promise to atone. Let her shiver, let her moan. I'll slam the door and let the hellcat free. Marry Freddy. Second nature to me now, like breathing out and breathing in. I'm very grateful she's a woman and so easy to forget. Rather like a habit one can always break. And yet, I've grown accustomed to the trace of something in the air, accustomed to her face.
Wash my face and hands afore I come, I did.
Eliza. Where the devil are my slippers?
Thank you.
You've been listening to Lerner and Lowe's My Fair Lady at the BBC Proms. Orchestrations by Alexander Courage, Al Woodbury and Robert Franklin, supervised by Andre Previn. The My Fair Lady ensemble on stage, including singers with supporting roles, Jamie Farr, Susan Fay, Gemma Wardle, Lynn Wilmot, Gillian Barton, Valerie Cutco, Julie Jupp, Jill Martin, Julia Sutton, Steve Elias, Adrian Grove and Stephen Matthews. John Barr, James Barron, Sam Hiller, Mark Meadows, Nigel Richards and John Stacey. Choreography was by Josh Prince, stage direction by Sean Kerrison. And now the principals. Jenny Galloway as Mrs. Pierce. Julian Ovenden was Freddie Eynsford-Hill. Sean Phillips, Mrs. Higgins. James Fleet played Colonel Pickering. Alan Armstrong, Alfred Doolittle. And entering from the sides of the stage, Anthony Andrews as Professor Henry Higgins and Annalene Beachy as Eliza Doolittle. My Fair Lady was played by the John Wilson Orchestra and conducted by John Wilson.
And that was Petrarch Trelawney at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Tuesday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Well, we return to the Royal Albert Hall tomorrow evening for our next prom, a performance of Debussy's opera Pelléas et Mélisande. And that starts at 7 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3, the home of the BBC Proms. Well, coming up next this evening at 10:30, Here and Now, we'll be hearing music by Giles Swain, Hugh Wood, Michael Nyman and Helmut Lachenmann. So to take us up to that, here's some music by Debussy. This is one of his 12 studies, played by Pascal Roger. Thank you. Pascal Roget played Debussy's Study No. 8. This is BBC Radio 3. The time is 10:30, and it's time for our weekly new music programme, Here and Now. Here's Robert Warby.
Tonight, the first of a pair of programmes from the Cheltenham Festival. We're going to hear two British string quartets played by the Castalion Quartet. The first had its premiere in Cheltenham 50 years ago, almost to the day. An exciting time for its composer.
Any young composer just hopes that he will get heard. But all the various occasions in those far-off days came as a pleasant surprise. I could never realise that it was happening to me. I do remember an early time when the Dartington Quartet were preparing a premiere of my first quartet. And I remember thinking, goodness, what luck. I can't believe that this is happening to me. And I've felt that more or less all my life, really.
The ever-youthful Hugh Wood, 80 this year. And we'll hear his first quartet in just a moment. The other work from that Cheltenham concert is part of the Encore scheme, a joint project between Radio 3 and the Royal Philharmonic Society to give repeat performances and broadcasts of works by living composers. Very much alive is Giles Swain. His third quartet, written in Africa with Australian and Simian inspiration, sees the light of day once again, a mere 19 years after its premiere. And after Cheltenham, we're off to Aldborough for the latest in our series of the Here and Now 50, Helmut Lachenmann's Mouvement für die Erstarrung, played by Ensemble Moderne. But first, here's Hugh Wood again.
The Cheltenham Festival very kindly discovered that my first string quartet, which happened to be my very first BBC commission ever, was done exactly 50 years ago. And first of all, they contrived to do it on the day. Actually, the 8th of July is not the day. The 5th of July was, where I had another performance here. So it's rather nice. The piece, it's nice for me, I don't know about other people, that the piece has lasted for 50 years. And even nicer, the composer has lasted for 50 years, really. It's got four movements, and it's one of the very first pieces after I had sort of fallen under the spell of the music of Schoenberg, which influenced it in various ways, various probably inaccurate ways. And the four movements build up to the finale. The first movement introduces lots of themes that you'll hear later on. It leads straight into a scherzo, which again was one of a series which I repeated in other pieces time and time again. Then there is a very small slow movement, and because it's small it's called adagietto, and that too is connected with the rest. And then there's the last movement is the most expansive one, and you'll hear lots of material that have been transformed from earlier versions of it earlier in the piece. And so this business of making the finale the most important movement, which Beethoven really started, is something that I followed there. And it's being excellently played by the quartet, which I've just heard them rehearsing, and they're really, really marvellous. And it's rather nice to think that none of them were even born when it was written.
And that quartet is the Castalion Quartet. Sadie Fields and Daniel Roberts, violins, Charlotte Bonton, viola, and Rebecca Herman, cello. Here they are, performing Hugh Wood's String Quartet No. 1. Thank you. String Quartet No. 1 by Hugh Wood. It was performed by the Castalion Quartet at the Cheltenham Festival last weekend. Next from this Cheltenham concert is Giles Swain's Third String Quartet. It's often said that the one thing harder to get than a first performance of a work is a second. A joint initiative by Radio 3 and the Royal Philharmonic Society seeks to address this. Here's Giles Swain.
I haven't heard this piece for a while. It was generously selected by the Royal Philharmonic Society Encore project for, as it were, revival. It was first played up near Leeds at Harwood House by the Schamper Quartet in 1993, I think. So I haven't heard it for 19 years, so I'm looking forward to it very much. As for the piece, I hate describing pieces, but if I have to, I can say that it's in one movement. I would think it's about 22, 23 minutes. And the ideas, there are kind of three ideas, and musical ideas, which make up all the material, almost, except I wrote it in very curious circumstances. I wrote it when I was living in the West African bush, in a house without water or electricity, which I'd built, most of the time with a small monkey sitting on my shoulder. And I wrote it page by page, almost like a long letter I was writing, because it was dedicated always to the memory of an old friend of mine called Betty Tuckwell, who was Barry Tuckwell's mother, who had recently died. And it's written in memory of her. And because she was an Aussie, the tune Waltzing Matilda pops up subliminally in various places. And then as we approach the end of the piece, the coda of the piece, which, if you like, is a depiction of her death or a celebration of her life, but it brings her very long, she was very old, her long life to a close, it comes complete in four-part canon. It's a canon at the minor third in four parts. And it's very, very stark and still and extremely slow. And then at the very end, you hear there's a pulse, also based on Waltzing Matilda, but just a rhythm. And then you hear a very high harmonic E, like somebody's cardiogram in a hospital stopping. And it's her life comes to a close. So the ingredients are this memorial or like a letter to an old friend who's died. At the same time, there's the opposite. There's the, because I had my monkey Cuckoo sitting on my shoulder most of the time when I was writing it, he keeps popping in and you hear pop pop cuckoo cuckoo coming in from time to time. So there's a kind of, he was young, youthful playfulness and old age coming to the end, or somebody coming, drawing to the end of a very long life. And then the Australian subtext coming through. Apart from that, there are kind of three melodic cells which are woven together all the way through to create the piece. And having said I don't like talking about music, I've just rabbited on for at least 8 minutes.
More like 3 minutes. That was Giles Swain, and this is his third string quartet, played by the Castalion Quartet.